KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
Welcome to the Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature and the human heart.
It's all alive. It's all connected. It's all intelligent. It's all relatives.
In the design world, when you're talking about regeneration of a place, you have choices that you make. And every design intervention, there's a decision whether you're going to participate in a feedback loop that is regenerative or degenerative. But what is fundamental, and this is the work that we all have to do, is we actually have to focus on love. Imagine going into design meetings with developers and say, let's talk about love. But my belief is that only through the sustained awakening of the human heart are we going to have a future.
In this episode, architect and designer Jason F. McLennan takes the revolution from the heart of nature and the human heart into our built environment. He's shifting the fateful civilizational inflection point we face from degradation to regeneration, from fear to love. I'm Neil Harvey. This is Designing for a Regenerative Future. What's love got to do with it?
We need to design our built environment in the same way that nature devises its architecture, running off of the sun rather than fossil fuels, using the water that we can capture and not polluting our environment. The important thing, of course, is that we solve these issues in an interconnected fashion. They aren't isolated issues. They are things that have to be solved together. And that holistic framing, if you will, is fundamental to the Living Building Challenge. And what we're trying to imagine, of course, is a world that actually is living, that will be worth living for.
Now, contrast that vision with current reality. In the U.S., buildings are the number one energy-using sector. They account for 40% of primary energy consumption, 39% of CO2 emissions, and 13% of water consumption. Instead, what would it feel like to live in a world where our built environment was as elegant as nature's designs? Where nature itself is our design model, mentor, and metric, so we live comfortably within its boundaries and limits. What if our built environment actually enhances natural systems? What if our living and working spaces nurture our human communities and quality of life? And yes, what's love got to do with it? Those paradigm-changing questions have inspired Jason McLennan's lifelong quest to design and build what he calls living buildings that are in harmony with nature and create vital healing spaces for people. He's among the world's most influential visionaries in contemporary architecture and green building. As a sought-after designer, consultant, and thought leader, he's the principal of McLennan Design. As a global design firm, it uses regenerative design to solve some of the most vexing challenges bedeviling society at this transformative inflection point. He published the influential WELL Building Standard and has written 7 books on sustainability and design, including the cornerstone in the field, The Philosophy of Sustainable Design. In 2006, McLennan transformed the still nascent field of green building with a shot across the bow called the Living Building Challenge. It conceptually leapfrogged the leading green building certification standards by a country mile. Jason McLennan spoke at a Bioneers conference.
I started writing the Living Building Challenge And the idea was that we needed to fundamentally change architecture, that we needed to reimagine the impact that our built environment was having on the world. And it was a bit crazy in people's minds, and I was told that this will never happen or be a long time, and I'm glad that that has been proven wrong. It was so far out there when we launched it, it was illegal, in fact, in just about every jurisdiction in North America, so we had to get to work on that. And it's amazing to think that doing things in support of life would be the thing that was illegal. So a lot has happened since I launched the challenge. I remember not only was it illegal, we had to change water laws in particular, and you couldn't find the materials, but of course energy, renewable energy at the time was more expensive, and now that's changed. The cheapest form of new energy is renewable energy, and that's incredible. It's amazing to think that when we launched the challenge, we didn't have smartphones. we didn't have Teslas. So this idea that we can now electrify everything is much more real, and people are doing it, and they're doing it all over the world, which is exciting. Again, which is good, it's progress, and we can imagine that we have all the tools now that we need to have a fundamentally different world.
The Living Building Challenge standards were so radical that initially, even when the practices were legal, there simply weren't any architects, developers, or construction companies that dare even to try to achieve them. But what may have seemed like wild-eyed idealism or fringe folly has matured into dozens of certified living buildings and thousands pursuing it on six continents. These efforts are rapidly spawning the beginnings of a global movement. The nonprofit Living Future Institute that McLennan founded, along with numerous other innovative organizations and companies, have been systematically disrupting and transforming an entire sector, the architecture, construction, and design industries. On the ground, the work has evolved from living buildings to initiatives to create entire living communities. The Living Building and Product standards include the world's first social justice label, called JUST. And that's not to mention certifications for zero carbon, zero energy, and more. In 2019, Jason McLennan connected with some colleagues in his Seattle home base who landed him smack in the middle of mainstream. The firm behind a billion-dollar stadium project in downtown Seattle, the new home of the National Hockey League's Seattle Kraken, was hoping to sell the naming rights to Amazon. Together, the Oak View Group and Amazon opted to call the venue Climate Pledge Arena, and they engaged McLennan as lead sustainability consultant to ensure that it lived up to its ambitious name.
I got involved. I got asked to figure out, well, how do we actually live up to this kind of name? What would we do differently? And this is a major sports venue, you know, 17,000, 18,000 people or something like that. First of all, there was this incredible 1962-era building for the Seattle World's Fair that was designed to be kind of like a rain hat, of Coast Salish-looking rain hat. And one option was that that would have been torn down. It's right next to the Space Needle. It was on National Historic Registry, and people love it. And there was a decision to keep it, which is the right decision. And they brought me in and said, okay, we have an opportunity to do something amazing and to be a beacon for the sports and entertainment industry and be the greenest venue of its kind in the world. And I said, well, the first thing you need to do is get rid of all the natural gas and have no fossil fuels inside the building. And that wasn't done for a building of that size. But they, to their credit, they said, okay, all right, we'll do that. Even though we've ordered the equipment, paid for it, we're going to cancel the orders, suck up the loss cost, and we're going to go all electric. And then the second thing was, well, but then we got to get our electricity from renewable sources. So we have to have on-site solar, which we put in a few places, and then and we'll have off-site renewable energy as well. And 100% of the energy will be from renewable energy sources. So now we've decarbonized the energy. We already had lower embodied carbon, because they were recycling the building. Then there was a decision to go even further and say, how do we actually track all the transportation of fans getting there, all the food purchased, all the materials that are used in the building, track the carbon footprint of that as well. And there's all sorts of other things that are pretty cool when you go there. Environmentally, it's not a huge benefit in Seattle, where it rains a lot. But it is cool that why would we not make the ice from rainwater? And why not do that everywhere? Why do you spend all this energy and resources to treat water and then use it to make ice when rain falls naturally on these big roofs of these venues? So it had been done once somewhere else, not for a professional hockey team. But I knew that rainwater was going to be actually a better source of ice. So we essentially put in cisterns, just like you would at your house with the rain barrel. We have a big rain barrel, though, under the plaza of the building. And we collect rainwater and we make NHL hockey ice on it. And the good news is that the experts there believe it's the best ice they've ever made, which I already knew was going to be. It's water is distilled. And they have to make sure that it's clear so you can see the puck on the ice and everything else, and they love it.
Even the beloved Zambonis that sweep the ice are electric and charged by renewable power. The Climate Pledge Arena aims to be the first zero-carbon stadium certified by the Living Building Challenge. The initiative is also pledging to produce zero waste and eliminate single-use plastics by 2024, which is unprecedented for a major arena. Although the stadium project is one high-profile result of decades of prior learning and practice, McLennan's efforts behind the scenes to transform the way we create the everyday products and materials that surround us has had widespread impact. He and his organization developed a red list of toxic chemicals, such as formaldehyde, PVC, and some flame retardants to eliminate from building materials. Now, red list-free products are available throughout the building industry. Taking a holistic, nature-based approach requires a fundamentally different mindset. Jason McLennan says it also engenders a change of heart. He spoke on a panel at a Bioneers conference.
The hardest barriers that we have found to do in regenerative projects, to do in living buildings, in the end are not technological, they're not economic, they're not educational, like know-how based. It has been the resistance that we face from people and attitudes and inertia of, well, that's not how we do it here, or that's not how we did it last time, or I don't know if you can do that, I'm afraid to do that, and all the excuses. And so there's just this inaction that happens. Yeah. My focus, of course, has been on primarily the environmental impact of the decisions we make around buildings, but you can't get into that in any authentic way and not understand that it's about people as well. And so the deeper you get into regeneration, the more you realize that the barriers to change, the barriers to regeneration are all between our ears and the way we think and the stories that we tell ourselves. So the ironic thing is that I talk about living buildings, but our buildings are not actually alive. They're actually more like, it's not the dam, it's the beaver that is the hydrologist. It's not the building, it's the people in the buildings. Mm-hmm. But our buildings are these sort of manifestations of our values, the things that we believe are important, our needs, our desires, and they're the biggest things that humans build, our buildings and cities. So they take the most stuff and they have the biggest legacies and the biggest impacts of the non-living things that we're surrounded by. And I think a lot of architects overstate the importance of architecture, and a lot of other disciplines misunderstand or underplay how important architecture is as a form giver for our values.
So how do we integrate the humanity, dignity, and purpose of people into the design of buildings and communities? Moving beyond bricks and mortar, McLennan became engaged with a next generation of living building projects that transformed his understanding of what a living building could be and do for the people using it. When we return, how reconciliation and love are the real drivers of regenerative change. I'm Neil Harvey. You're listening to The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature. You can visit bioneers.org to subscribe to our newsletters and podcasts. Check out deep dives on the topics that matter to you most and learn about our events. That's bioneers.org. Clearly, one barrier to the spread of living buildings and living communities has been inertia, or what you might call intention deficit disorder. Yet as these inspiring models do get built and seen, people love them and want more of them. According to Jason McLennan, it's biophilia in action, the innate love and attraction that life has for life. The question becomes, can we translate that love both to the natural world and to our fellow human beings? From the pyramids to skyscrapers, our built environment vividly shows that that has not been the story so far.
But what is fundamental, and this is the work that we all have to do, and this is the work that we're trying to do in our practice more and more, which is a tough thing for architects to admit that it's not about the buildings, is we actually have to focus on love. You imagine going into design meetings with developers and say, let's talk about love. But my belief is that only through the sustained awakening of the human heart are we going to have a future. In the design world, when you're talking about regeneration of a place, you have choices that you make in what you do and how you design. So there's this point of action. And every design intervention, there's a decision whether you're going to participate in a feedback loop that is regenerative or degenerative. But more than that, bigger than that now, is the idea that there is this need for love and reconciliation. And that same decision point is the decision point between fear and love and feedback loops that are either bringing us together as a people and as life on this planet or moving us apart. And after decades and decades of this in any culture, in any country, it builds into this insidious form of institutional racism, institutional harm that is done. Most people don't even see. And these same forces are there with institutional environmental degradation. And so this is what we have to overcome. And as you go from thinking about people and other species, you understand that it's the same root issues, the same fear, the same lack of love allows us to justify our cruelty, not only to each other, but to all of life. And that's why, in my mind, it's clear, and I understand, of course, it's clear to the people in Bioneers that environmentalism and social justice are truly two sides of the same coin.
As the scholar and activist Cornel West has said, justice is what love looks like in public. So if we're talking about love, then what's justice got to do with it? Are living buildings to be only for the wealthy?
The systems that we have benefit certain people, and they don't want those systems to change, as you might imagine. If you're the beneficiary of a lopsided system, you know, obviously, if I had all the resources in the world, I would love to see living buildings for those that can't afford to pay for good infrastructure of any kind right now. It would be nice if affordable housing were all living buildings and they'd never have energy bills and water bills to worry about. And they were more comfortable and they lived in a healthier environment so their kids wouldn't have asthma and allergies and sort of perpetuate the cycle of always being at a disadvantage because of the poor infrastructure that they have. The rich can take care of themselves, but you know, if we wanted to design or retrofit our cities to be truly sustainable, and by we, I mean a very large collective we of really smart people, we know how to do that. We could transform our energy systems, our water systems, our waste systems, our food systems. We could do that within a few years, in a decade. I believe that. I believe we could get off of fossil fuels, for example, in a short amount of time, if we could get out of our own way, and if we could solve those huge political hurdles that get put in place. We should be, as a culture, in this unparalleled moment of decarbonization, that if there was the real political leadership, real moral leadership in this country, that this would be a discussion of, like, not a question of if or how long or these vague targets of 2050, 2040, 2030. It should be like, we are going to transition our economy and we all need to come together on this, and this is what we're going to do. And then actually do it, we need to engage in a more quick way.
Jason McLennan says he's been doing a whole lot of soul searching about where this work has had the most impact or less impact. He finds himself continually coming back to the projects that embrace reconciliation as the heart of regeneration. One of those endeavors was in partnership with the Ngāi-Tūwē, a tribe from the Northern Ireland on Otirua, New Zealand. In the 2010s, work began on the design and construction of their new parliament building and community center. The building site was adjacent to their ancestral homeland, a vast area of rugged, forested hill country formerly designated as a national park. Like indigenous communities worldwide, the Tūwē have experienced waves of colonization, land theft, and settler violence. It has included the confiscation of the best agricultural lands, accompanied by brutal military campaigns targeting their settlements. In 2014, their ancestral home was returned to them as part of a transformative national reparations settlement. A design team worked with the Tūwē to co-create a design process inspired by the Living Building Challenge that incorporated an active process of reparations and reconciliation. The goal was to conceive of and build a structure that healed not only the community, but the land itself. The question was, could that process help justice become love made public?
They shared it with the chief and members of the clan, and they resonated with it immediately and said, oh, this is another way of saying what we believe. And it became then a really useful tool for the architects and engineers and builders and the Tūwē to talk about the values and the goals and the vision for what success would look like if they could build a building that would embody who they were and their relationship to the land. And so that was really kind of cool. And so, yeah, the Living Building became a rallying cry. You know, the whole community got involved, literally. I mean, they made earth blocks together, and there's some great photos sometimes I show of people, you know, from the Tūwē making earth blocks that were the walls of the facility, and you had that happening, as well as you had a lot of sort of big glue laminated timbers from New Zealand forests that were brought in with, you know, big equipment. So it was this high-tech, low-tech, centuries-old way of doing things and modern ways of doing things coming together. It actually was the first living building in the country, which is great. Now there's several other living buildings in New Zealand, and it was inspiring to be part of that.
Known as Te Kura Whare, the Living Building certified structure is now a thriving community hub. It's 100% off the grid and off fossil fuels. It collects and treats all water on site. It was built by the community, with materials caringly harvested from the surrounding lands. Yet it's so much more than just a structure. The New Zealand Property Council described the deep community process design approach as transformative. It's now used as a model practice in New Zealand and beyond, and a glimmer of what a living community can be and do. It starts with a change of heart.
We have to be able to have uncomfortable conversations. We have to be able to accept that we have had an impact on other people. We have to ask for forgiveness. We have to make amends. We have to stop the damage. We have to work together to heal and design systems together. You cannot heal an ecosystem without healing yourself. And the beautiful thing, though, is if you begin to heal an ecosystem, you will heal yourself. Because it is an opening up of your heart. And that's this amazing thing, is when you start this journey of opening your heart to love and asking for forgiveness and making amends and working together, it is a powerful path, in my mind, to both, again, reconciliation and regeneration. And you can begin it anywhere. All of us here have a journey, some more deeply than others, perhaps.
As the renowned ecologist and biomimicry designer Janine Benyus famously put it, what life does is to create conditions conducive to life. Like the Gaia hypothesis, it's the idea that the entire symphony of all living things self-regulates the Earth's conditions to make the physical environment more hospitable for them in an exquisite, dynamic balance. Think of it as a vast hospitality enterprise.
And the world wants to heal. It wants to regenerate. Its life is the only thing in the universe that we know that resists entropy. It wants to come back. And I think, and what I would add to Janine's quote is, love creates the conditions for love. And so where you begin, that's up to you. There's so many places, peoples, cultures that we need to reconcile with as a society. We need to obviously reconcile within ourselves. And there's so much regenerative work that needs to be done. And these are like interlooping spirals of work, I think. And one without the other doesn't work. And I hope that that can extend, of course, not only to the people that look like us and other people generally, but to all of life. When we begin to see the world as one interconnected system, of which we are just one critical part, and when all people and all life are deemed valuable, then we will make it. And only then will we have a future. And we can either decide to take that point of inflection that I showed earlier and move towards love, regeneration, and reconciliation, or move towards degradation, divisiveness, and essentially consume ourselves out of a planet. I think I know the secret to life. It's to be in right relationship to all living things. And to be personally reconciled with our role of life on the planet. And so we need to let go of our old ways of thinking and become a new kind of human. Maybe Homo regenesis. And if you're Homo regenesis, you do recognize that you're just one part in an interconnected system of all life on the planet, and that we're all beautiful and we all have a role to play in healing and making sure that there's conditions for life to thrive, using love as the conditions for life to thrive. It feels at times like that starfish story, right? You guys know the starfish story of this young child is throwing starfish back in the water, and someone says, well, what good is that? It doesn't matter. Look at all the starfish on the beach. And she says, it matters to this one. It matters to this one. So I don't know how many people we have to touch. I don't know how much is enough. I guess we'll find that out. But all I know is that I'm doing the work that I do and doing the best I can, and I hope that you are as well. Thank you.
Jason F. McLennan, Designing for a Regenerative Future. What's Love Got to Do with It? Executive Producer Kenny Ausubel. Written by Kenny Ausubel. Senior Producer and Station Relations, Stephanie Welch. Program Engineer and Music Supervisor, Emily Harris. Producer, Teo Grossman. Host and Consulting Producer, Neil Harvey. Production Assistants, Anna Rubinova and Monica Lopez. My name is Neil Harvey. Thank you for listening. This is program number 255.
Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the program.
When Maureen Grant died in 2021, there was an outpouring of nostalgia in the show business world familiar with the Olympia Theatre. Mrs. Grant had reached the magnificent age of 96, and for more than 70 of those 96 years, she had worked in the smaller of the two Olympia parterre bars. When I first knew her, Maureen was notable for a towering beehive hairdo, coal black and immovable above her red uniform waistcoat. As the years went on, a grey, curly mop head style supplanted the beehive. But the most notable thing about Maureen was her memory. She knew everyone's drink and would raise an eyebrow, followed by a nod, when her regulars came through the door before curtain up, with their second round lined up unasked at their favourite table for the interval. When she went looking for a job in the Olympia in 1949, she was heavily pregnant, but somehow didn't get round to mentioning the fact in an era when married women were a rarity in the workplace. She gave birth during her annual two-week holiday, and without mentioning it, she arrived back at work as scheduled after the 2 weeks. Baby came too, where he was hung in a shawl sling on the back of the lavatory door. She did the same with the following seven offspring. Sometimes there would be three small grants scattered in different spots around the Olympia. It was only when Maureen was pregnant with number eight, after a bad fall that put her in hospital for a few weeks, that the then co-owner manager, the legendary Stanley Ilsley of Ilsley McCabe Productions, mentioned he'd heard that the bar girl, Miss Grant, had a baby while in hospital. Only then did someone tell him that Miss Grant was in fact Mrs. Grant, and the new baby had seven brothers and sisters at home. So it was not surprising that the management of the Olympia, undertaking a refurbishment of the sadly run-down theatre in the 1990s, decided with great flourish and publicity to name Maureen's Kingdom after her, and the small parterre bar had a new sign nailed above the door, Maureen's Bar. But what few remembered was the provenance of the previous name, Kelly's Bar. That should have been Miss Kelly's Bar, because the name honoured a figure of not such long standing as Maureen Grant, but every bit as impressively and awesomely eccentric, with nobody ever daring to use her first name. Never was there a figure less like the flamboyantly glamorous Maureen. It was largely due to Noel Pearson during his equally flamboyant years as theatre impresario on the Dublin scene that Miss Kelly, at his instigation, gained titular prominence. But when the proscenium arch dramatically collapsed in 1974, fortunately while the theatre was briefly empty, it seemed it might never open again. But it did after 3 years, a time lag that might have allowed Miss Kelly's name to fade from memory. But Miss Kelly had a basilisk glare, and I don't think I ever remember seeing her smile. Tiny, slightly humpbacked, her personal uniform was a sagging grey cardigan and a baggy, almost ankle-length skirt, under which could be seen comfortably thick, fawn-coloured lisle-thread stockings, and the kind of lace-up shoes of indeterminate shape usually confined to the wardrobes of nuns. The whole was topped off by grey hair in a bun kept in strict place by a hairnet. One glance, and you knew there was no messing with Miss Kelly. I got the rough side of Miss Kelly's tongue myself on one occasion. I'd written a book of interviews called The Permissive Society in Ireland? The publishers, Mercier, had a cover designed which showed a classical print of Adam and Eve leaving the Garden of Eden, naked and with heads bowed. It was black and white, save for two large green shamrocks placed strategically. It was a great cover, but not in Miss Kelly's eyes, as I discovered when someone showed her a copy and pointed me out as the author. For someone so young, I learned, I was a disgrace, and no decent person would ever read such filth. Such was the power of Miss Kelly's glare that I apologised for my unseemly behaviour. And in subsequent conversation, I learned that Miss Kelly, who must have been at least in her late 70s, walked home alone each night from the theatre. Horrified, I asked if the bosses wouldn't give her a taxi. No, she growled indignantly, did I think she'd take the risk of getting into a car with a man? You would know what they'd be getting up to. That was Miss Kelly, who went on to be immortalised with the sign Kelly's Bar above the door of her kingdom, back in the days when even her colleague, the legendary Maureen Grant, knew better than to talk back to her.
Making your way in the world today takes everything you've got. Taking a break from all your worries sure could help a lot. Wouldn't you like to get away? Sometimes you want to go where everybody knows your name.
I'm currently drinking my way through a menu of exotic teas, including artichoke and chrysanthemum. Today's choice is dragon, an oolong variety with a refreshing fruity flavour. I peer into the leafy interior of my pale porcelain cup. Long twisty leaves in shades from light green to black reinforce the association with that serpentine creature of folklore, the dragon. I regard the formations I see in my tea leaves, while not completely accurate portals to past, present or future, as being more than prompts for flights of fancy. You see, I have an uncanny knack of accurately reading the symbols presented by these leaves, borne out by the frequent visits of friends in search of my tea leaf guidance. Inherited intuition, I like to call it. Often, I drift back in memory to how crucial tea leaves were in my childhood home. Loose lips sink ships goes the saying, but loose tea leaves provided emotional ballast for a small community of women through the buffeting waves of the hungry 50s. Mother and her coterie of neighbours liked nothing better than to decipher an abundance of thick loose leaves in their teacups. Her weekly gatherings in our tiny kitchen could scarcely compare with the salons of the Enlightenment, hotbeds of revolution, hosted by celebrity ladies such as Sophie de Condorcet or Suzanne Curchod, wife of Jacques Necker. However, Mother's weekly infusions added a frisson of drama to otherwise humdrum lives. Grievances were safely aired by the more cunning clairvoyant through stealthy readings of tea leaf hieroglyphics. A tea leaf prophecy made a perfect foil, for example, for outing the owner of unsupervised roaming canines, regularly leaving unwanted deposits in gardens other than their own. The imminent arrival of a tall, dark stranger was aimed solely towards a spinster who hid her blushes beneath a heavy coat of rouge. Voltaire once said, "The longer we dwell on our misfortunes, the greater is their power to harm us." I discovered as I grew older there was a code of ethics in that kitchen. Doomsday situations seldom triumphed over prophecies of good fortune. Everyone left not so much shaken as pleasantly stirred by witty conversation, humour and, if help was needed, generosity. Under the guise of clairvoyance, when reading a clump of tea leaves, whatever burdens beset these women were thrashed out, confidentiality guaranteed. While these domestic forums unfolded, as a small child I stared out over the edge of a tea chest, a practical solution for keeping toddlers safe where the only source of heating was the Stanley range. The tea chest occupied a place in every house in that street, serving its time either as a kind of playpen or as a storage facility for bed linen. Covered with a cloth, it served as both storage unit and side table. Resilient and durable layers of thin wood were lined with crinkly silver foil to protect the tea. Its time served, it might go on to be used as fuel, literally keeping the home fires burning. Nowadays, these multifunctional chests are a DIY enthusiast's must-have, and rare enough too. Following after two brothers and three sisters, my own containment in this wooden nest was inevitable. Even before I could stand unaided, I remember looking out at Mother and her tea salon cronies, while they in turn, during a lull in prophecy, confession, or idle speculation,
tried to determine whether I had the cut of my father's jib or the telltale wave of my mother's cowslick. For all I knew, that tea chest may have travelled the Silk Road along a network of trade routes between the East and Europe, the route which brought Marco Polo to Kublai Khan's palace. Or it may have crossed the humid sea from China. Multitudes of tea chests must have made their way to England over the centuries and onto Irish shores. I'd love to think that my tea chest was somehow connected to the ancient Tea Horse Road, a route through Yunnan, Sichuan and Tibet. To exchange tea for horses, traders in Yunnan provinces travelled with pack horses to Tibet by foot and horseback. It's said that when you stand on the horse trade road, you can still see deep ruts stamped in stone by horses' hooves. If it came from China, that's thanks to the efforts of Samuel Bewley and his son Charles, cutting out the middleman, the East India Company, in 1835 and importing directly from Canton to Dublin. But more than likely, my tea chest found its way from India, filled with Assam leaves. Mother's tea was heavier and darker hued than the preference I now have for lighter, more delicate teas. My small, though self-contained vessel, strewn with squeaky toys, was often, too, a soothing salve for teething gums as I bore down on soft wood while listening to the comforting sound of laughter. That sound is forever imprinted on my memory, echoing like those hooves on the Tea Horse Road. It grows deeper with each passing year.
We arrived into sixth year in the autumn of 1969, 17 of us, to find a new headmaster in the school, a man called Brendan Maher. And with him, he brought a new regime, more open, more liberal, one that treated us not as children, but as the young men we were becoming. One of the perks he introduced was a smoking room for sixth years. Very few of us actually smoked, but in those less informed times, the idea of a smoking room reserved for our aspiring troop spoke of maturity and a place of privacy where we could have adult conversations. The room was actually the dressing room of the school theatre, a warm place that smelled of timber and grease paint, but one that reeked of the possibilities that lay ahead for our little group. On wet afternoons, on breaks from study, on Sunday evenings, we would gather in that small space and ruminate on the problems of the world and the solutions that were obvious to our 17-year-old eyes. There was no problem beyond resolution, no injustice that couldn't be righted by revolution, no fantasy love across the wall in Laurel Hill Convent who couldn't be won, no community that wouldn't be improved. We were young and naive, but more importantly, we were driven by the desire to change the world and make it a better place. The one thing that never crossed our minds was the thought that we would grow older, that life would be short for some, tough for others, impossible for one or two, and a disappointment for many. The goals we set ourselves, the changes we planned, the influence we believed we would have on the world turned out in many cases to be beyond our reach. There was no greyness back then, just right and wrong, good and evil, choices that needed to be made. We were filled with righteous anger, with hope, with aspirations, with a belief in our own generation and its power to make the world a brighter, better, more equitable place. I thought about that time, those hopes, that room the other day, as I listened to Judy Collins singing the song Bob Dylan's Dream. It took me back to the swirls of cigarette smoke, to the laughter and the arguments, the desires and aspirations, to the earnest faces of the young men we were, to the absolute belief we had in the decency of our ideas and ideals. And then, out of the fading smoke memories and the crumbling walls of that remembered room, came the names of the young men with whom I shared the space. Men who achieved the unimagined. Men who lived their lives in quietness or recklessness. Faces which never reappeared at reunions. Names which surfaced far too soon in obituary columns. Smiles which lit the fading evening light in that warm space and were never seen again. This year, the fates allowing, those of us who are still alive will gather in Limerick to celebrate the 60th anniversary of our arrival there and the 55th anniversary of our days in the room. No doubt there will be much laughter and some silence. Memories of early hours on the stairs trudging our way to morning prayer. Remembrances of afternoons on the sports pitches. And recollections of evenings in the room that was our space, our launch pad, the alpha and sometimes omega of so many hopes. We were driven then by the beliefs, the arguments, the disagreements, the desires that we held collectively and individually. Beliefs that had a sacredness about them. And that room was a place where we could try them and test them, attack and defend them, laugh about them, and quietly contemplate them before the world through its walls and ditches and losses and disappointments in our way. I wish in vain that we could sit simply in that room again. $10,000 at the drop of a hat, I'd give it all gladly if our lives could be like that. As I listened to Judy Collins sing the last yearning verse, I too wished that we could all be back there in that room, safe in the knowledge of what lay ahead, armed with the ability to make the best of the good and to avoid the worst that lurked in the years to ambush us. But that's not how life is, other than in dreams.
In the winter of 1947, Ireland was buried in snow. Snow filled each hollow and ditch, piled against every hedgerow. It blocked roads and shut down schools. The blizzard seethed for weeks, delivered by an Arctic storm that raged and wrathed over the country. My father was 9 years old. In the winter of 1947, he shoveled a path to the coop so his mother, my grandmother, could feed the hens. The family lived for weeks on eggs and soda bread. His father, my grandfather, the village postman, carried his bicycle on one shoulder and the post bag on the other, wading through 10 feet of snow. He died before I was born and was known to me only ever as the postman who waded through 10 feet of snow in the winter of 1947 with his bicycle on one shoulder and the postbag on the other. The winter of 1947 was the yardstick. Every snowfall in the next 80 years was judged by its measure. The figure of my grandfather strode through each winter storm. Every snowfall or cold snap was sure to be accompanied by another rendition of the tale, and it grew weary. Our parents' stories are the backdrop on which we make our own. Last winter, I awoke on the narrow boat where I had been living in London. I pulled the duvet around my ears, a deep splintering ricocheted outside. I sat up. Crack. My breath lingered. I wiped the frost off a small porthole by the bed. Coots and moorhens walked on the canal. Ducks with heads tucked beneath their wings melted themselves into icy nests. My breath smeared the glass and froze. Crack. The boat rocked, shifting in the ice. I checked the weather app on my phone. -5 degrees today in London. Taking the duvet with me, I shuffled to the galley and consulted my thermometer. -2 degrees inside the boat. I discarded the duvet and abandoned ship for the refuge of a warm cafe. As my fingers warmed, I dialed the only number I have ever committed to memory. Home. Dad spent most of that winter by his stove, where few stories could be made, so he had come around to hearing ours. I told him of my ice-bound boat, the ducks that sat in melting ringlets of their own warmth. Of course, it was nothing like the winter of 1947, when the snow was 10 feet deep, when the landscape vanished beyond recognition. I walked past King's Cross in the snow, still recognizable. Damn. I went back to the boat and stepped aboard. Crack. Snow fell, daubing a soft veneer on the ice. A few years ago, I sailed to the Arctic. I piloted a crew among monstrous icebergs sharp as shark's teeth. In the distance, bergs shattered and sheared as fragments tore and tumbled to the sea. The crew held a lookout for growlers, small bergs that would rip our hull if we took them hard. When I made landfall in Greenland, I wrote Dad a postcard about frozen seas and polar bears, about fogs as thick as the ice they cleared to reveal. My postcard was taken by helicopter to Nunavut, by airplane to Denmark, and onward to Ireland within just a few days. There had never been a postal service like it. At least, not since my grandfather delivered the post through 10 feet of snow in the winter of 1947. I stepped inside the canal boat and pulled off my boots. Dad had repeated the basics of fire building on the phone. Pack it tight, not too tight, get the chimney hot. The kindling crackled. Outside, snow continued to fall, and I hoped it would come for days, that I would have to break through this ice and dig through snow and have a tale worthy of telling. But instead, I stared into the meagre flames and wondered why my grandfather bothered. Through 10 feet of snow, bringing his bicycle to deliver the post.
A soldier, what would I do but I'd follow the gun? What would you do if you married a soldier? What would I do but I'd follow the gun? Oh, what would you do if he died in the ocean? What would I do but I'd marry again? What would you do if he died in the ocean? What would I do but I'd marry again?
Once upon a time, I was a green and rust bird who covered the babes in the woods with leaves. And the babes were adults, lying there on the stage, all cuddled up and hiding from the witch. And once there was a tiny wooden man sitting on my father's knee. He had swirly eyes and a stiff chin that moved up and down. Daddy was trying to speak with his mouth closed and pretend that it was the little man who was talking, but I knew that it was him. Sometimes Daddy becomes the pantomime devil with a deep, evil laugh. And he's really scary. My mother becomes the principal boy because she's got legs that look great in fishnet tights and they should be insured, she says, like Ginger Rogers. It's dark backstage and we try to walk quietly but our taps are too loud. Be quiet, shh, shh. Standing behind the thick red curtain, our faces bathed in its velvety hue, me and my two sisters, Emer and Elaine, and four rows of girls dressed in sateen with blinky sequins, legs slippy with grease paint, whitened tap shoes and new ankle socks. Daddy is front of curtain telling jokes and the audience is laughing. I can hear by his voice that he's coming to the end, and I look down to check that I'm standing in the centre of my chalked circle. Otherwise, I'll block one of the girls behind me and her parents won't be able to see her. Last night, Mammy twirled each curl around her finger and secured it with three clips. In the night, they pierced and prodded my scalp, but I didn't mind. Now my hair has been brushed out so that it will bounce on my shoulders. The applause sounds like heavy rain, and the curtain is already swishing open and closing up on either side like a fan. I must get it right, because there are girls behind me who imitate everything I do. The pianist is already playing. Da-da-da-da-dee-da. We raise our right arms, theirs, and each right foot stamps no business like show business. And we're off, feet bouncing like hailstones on the scratched wooden boards. Breathless, we tiptoe across the back of the stage and down to the dressing room. There are chipped stars on the doors and lights around the spotty mirrors. And the backstage helpers are already getting my little sister Emma ready so that she can stand on a stool and sing Ain't She Sweet. And Elaine has a cardboard hat covered with red cloth and buttons. There is a fairy godmother with a wand made from tinfoil, and the ugly sisters, who are really men, are painting beauty spots onto their chins. I breathe in the scent of tull as the next costume floats down over my face. Then I crisscross pink ribbons around my shins and race back upstairs with Elaine and Jennifer. One, two, three, our ballet feet shush, shush across the stage. The lights are all coloured like sucky sweets, and Mammy is hiding in the wings singing Feed the Birds. My fingers are feathers, and my arm is curved like a swan's neck. There's a floaty sensation in my tummy, and we're swirling like snow or feathers after a pillow fight. For the finale, there's a lot of marching and bowing. We are given purple boxes of chocolates with pictures of kittens or puppies on the cover, and Mammy is given a huge bunch of flowers that she hugs, making the cellophane crinkle and crack. My Mammy is beautiful, and when she kisses Daddy, he has a red lipstick mouth on his cheek. We get dressed and hang around behind the curtain until everyone is gone. Our shoes and socks are dusty and grubby. It gets cold and Emer starts to whinge. Daddy gets the van and piles it up with costumes and props. Mammy puts on our coats and loads us into the back seat of the car. I never remember how we get home and into bed. When I wake in the morning, it will be time for school. My hair will be tied in a ponytail and I'll have to eat lumpy porridge like Oliver's gruel. But my legs will still be tanned. And when teacher calls my name and I raise my hand to say, Ansha, a gold sequin will fall onto the desk.
Bed, bed, I couldn't go to bed. My head's too light to try to set it down. Sleep, sleep, I couldn't sleep tonight. Not for all the jewels in the crown. I could have danced all night. I could have danced all night. And still have begged for...
Broadcasters like me who do interviews, especially live interviews, are well aware that something unexpected can suddenly happen which undermines whatever we had planned and makes us think again, fast. But we don't expect that to happen before the interview has even started. And yet that's exactly what did happen in one of my fledgling performances with the BBC in Belfast in the 1960s. It was the evening I interviewed two of the biggest names of the day in theatre and literature, Sir Tyrone Guthrie and Frank O'Connor. They had come to Broadcasting House a few hours earlier that afternoon to take part in a radio arts programme and had agreed to stay on to be interviewed by me on the television programme 6 o'clock. They spent the intervening time in the green room with some old friends. When they were eventually escorted to the studio and introduced